Life expectancy content is for informational and storytelling purposes only. We are not medical professionals, and nothing discussed in this episode or contained on the life expectancy website should be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you're facing medical concerns, addiction, or any health-related challenges, please seek guidance from a qualified medical professional or a licensed healthcare provider. Thank you for being a part of our journey, and we encourage you to seek support from trusted professionals when needed.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. I'm Stacy.
I'm Julie.
And we're here to talk about roles today. We're exploring the roles of individuals that you may encounter during your severe or terminal illness, like I did, such as patient, which would be my role, partner, which would have been my partner's role, POC, health advocate, doctors, nurses, coordinators, and even, like in my case, hospice. So I'm going to let Julie take the lead on a lot of this because she's the most knowledgeable, but we'll have some stuff to say.
Yeah, so I'm excited about this episode because when we were going through this, if I had had anyone talk to me about some of the people and things that I would be encountering, I would have been able to maybe in my mind ahead of time sort of know what to expect. How should I talk to a doctor versus a social worker versus a hospice care coordinator? I think that I learned a lot. This is our story. So I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an official healthcare advocate. I'm her healthcare advocate. So what we're really expressing is our personal experience, but a lot of these things are universal across the board. And there are some, dare I say it, tips and tricks that I can tell people about. You know, if somebody was coming to me and you in a similar situation asking, well, what should I know? So this podcast is about that. It's about the things that I wish I knew.
Experience definitely does play a part into this. And like you said, had someone said certain things to me that could have alleviated or made things easier, I would have definitely listened up and appreciated. This would have been a podcast I would listen to while I was going through this because I feel like community, it's so helpful, you know, the information.
Yeah, and I think I wouldn't have felt so alone. I would have felt like I had somebody in my corner. We've talked about this before, and it comes up in almost every podcast. I was thinking about this the other day. We always end up having something to say about feeling isolated. Whether I was individually isolated, you were individually isolated, we were in a bubble together. And if something like this had existed, I absolutely would have listened to it because I would have been walking on my little breaks from your hospital room. Instead of thinking this is impossible, I would have been thinking, okay, somebody else has walked through this before.
A helpful roadmap.
Absolutely.
For sure.
And also, there's a community of people. There's somebody else, like a human experience. Somebody else has done this.
Because it's so scary. And isolating is exactly the right word, Julie. It is scary and it feels like no one's been there. And any sort of support that you can get or, you know, people with experience, it's so helpful.
Working on what are uncharted waters when you're walking through them, surrounded by healthcare professionals that have had to desensitize and are doing this every day. So there is a weird juxtaposition or like difference between how you're feeling, experiencing everything new and everything feels big, to they have 18 people on this floor, all of which are dealing with similar things. And so bridging that gap, I think, is important. So if I had known a little bit of what to expect, I might have been a little less surprised, or I would have maybe been able to more calmly approach. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's like a car accident. You have initial hit and then you process and figure out, okay, here's what I'm going to do. So if we could take away some of that initial hit for people, you know, maybe. So that's what today's about. So I want to start by talking about the advanced health directive at a hospital.
Okay.
Or at a doctor's office.
So totally new stuff to me.
So when you are going to be admitted, in the case of Stacy, she would go into the ER for an incident. If they decide to admit her, right, at that point in the ER, they collect whatever insurance information you have, if you do or you don't. if you go to a Research One hospital or a state hospital, oftentimes they aren't going to worry about admitting you so much as they would potentially at a private hospital.
But when you say Research One, what do you mean?
I mean a hospital where they're doing cutting edge research, clinical trials, transplant.
Okay, because I thought maybe you meant like student teaching hospital.
Oh, no.
You don't mean that.
So the thing, I didn't mean that, but a lot of them are both those things at the same time.
Okay.
Because people are there. So the doctors are doing their work as an MD in their specialization, but they're also doing research behind the scenes on drugs or transplants or whatever. And so they always have residents and others.
Okay.
Almost every hospital is going to have some series of residents, right? So new doctors that have to do so many years before they can become part of the team differently. It's working your way up a ladder.
Yeah.
But in a state-funded hospital or a federally funded hospital or those that are doing research, scientific research, what ends up happening is in addition to it being a teaching hospital, it's also a place where they're getting usually state or federal funding to do certain other things. Without insurance in those cases, they're going to ask you a little bit later, perhaps, than some of the privatized hospitals, where it becomes a conversation a little bit sooner in the ER. But for example, in the ER, you're there, you get admitted. The doctors decide that you're ill enough that you have to be admitted. Okay, well, at that point then, we're waiting on a bed. So some other podcasts will talk about that. But you have to fill out something, or they'll encourage you. You don't have to fill out something called an advanced health directive. That's the official term for figuring out who is your POA, your power of attorney, and all of that. But even if you don't fill that out, they're going to ask you, who is your emergency contact? Who is the person that makes decisions for you in the event that you cannot?
This is important.
So there's a lot that goes along with that. Becoming the person that's someone's emergency contact does not make you financially responsible for that person, which is important to note.
Yeah.
It just makes it so that the patient, well, two things. When you are a person's emergency contact, I am now
a decision maker.
Yes, in the event that she can't, but also HIPAA rules state that unless she gives permission to me at that point, the doctors can't even tell me anything about your condition.
Right.
So that's the first line there, is that having a person with you that the hospital and doctors are allowed
share all information.
To share. That's right. So that we're there. So that's the first thing. So identifying that person. And what I want to encourage people to do is to really think about who that person should be for you. It's not always the person that's closest to you.
In my case, it was not my partner. He was not as knowledgeable as my sister, and I wasn't exactly clear that if things went bad, he would honor my wishes if my wishes were not to be
despite
revived.
His own.
Yeah. And it was a difficult conversation. It was tricky for me to come to this decision. It was accepted amongst all the parties, you know, my sister who stepped up, my partner who kind of understood, and I think in a small way felt relieved that that decision wasn't on him. But, well, so it's an important decision that the patient makes.
Yes, the patient has to make this decision, but I will say it's hard, but asking yourself if you're the patient whether you want to put that pressure on your partner. So
that's
sometimes it's not just that, can they make autonomous decisions in my name? Like, knowing what I want, will they follow through? But it's also, do you want to put that on them? In your case, Stacy's partner was working a full-time job, holding down at that point the bills.
A one-income household.
So on top of working all day long and worrying about you, then when was he going to come to the hospital then after that for another 5-6 hours?
In my initial directive, I did not want to be revived.
Correct.
If
she was DNR, do not resuscitate.
Quality of life was very important to me. What my life would look like after had I made it out. So there were certain stipulations that I had that he didn't necessarily agree with. And I knew that he didn't agree with that. And so questioning whether what I wanted was really going to happen. It's a very important, very serious decision that the patient has to make.
I guess what I will say, a lot of times the layman's term is that you're my person, right? This is a good translation. So if you're out in the world and you're like, that's my person, The problem with that is that sometimes your person is going to feel really bad having to do these things. So if Stacy had gone into a situation where I had to honor her wishes for do not resuscitate or DNR, I would have had to live with that choice. Even though it's her choice and I'm honoring her wishes, ultimately I'm the one that signs that paperwork or says, do it, take her off a ventilator. So it is responsibility. Now, I was happy to take that responsibility on because I personally found honor in adhering to her wishes, the way that she wanted to live her life, and that I was honoring her and myself and our relationship by maintaining her autonomy and allowing that to be to the letter of what she wanted.
And also, it is important to note that this was not Julie's first rodeo. I was not the first person to put her in this position. She had made this decision with other relatives. So I felt confident that she could handle it and she would honor my wishes and that she had the strength to follow through. It's a hard thing to ask anybody to do.
It is. Yeah. So you can start by saying that this person is your emergency contact and they are allowed to receive any medical information regarding you. So that's the basic level. But they also have paperwork that they'll give you called an advanced health directive if they believe that your condition could lead or has a high probability of leading to something where you would be on a ventilator, unable to speak for yourself, or if you were terminal.
And mine did.
Yes, and all of those levels at different times.
Yeah.
So that advanced health directive is something that you sign that in it has something called a POA or power of attorney. So now Stacy has to, as a patient, has to make a decision not only to share her medical information with me, but is she going to give me the power to maintain her finances, to write, to basically endorse a check for her, to pay bills for her? And at some hospitals, but not all, it also can make that person financially responsible for you. Now, that's not common, but it does occur. So you want to read that paperwork very carefully. And often, if you fill all of that out, and it's a lot, and usually hospitals have a notary, so you have to have a notary come up and witness and sign, and you have to have regular witnesses that cannot be family. And this can be problematic because some hospitals have rules that say that people who work for them cannot be witnesses on POA's advanced health directives because they don't want to end up in court fighting other family. And I'm sure that's happened. Johns Hopkins is a good example where you cannot use any medical professional to witness or if they're a notary to notarize any POA or advanced health directive.
In general, do not take this lightly. As you can see, all these other parties are involved. It is an important decision and it does become official.
But you can put an end date on it. And advanced health directives and POAs that you do in the hospital sometimes only work when you're in that hospital. Not just for that one event, but anytime you would be admitted to that particular hospital. They often don't translate from one hospital to the next. So if you are going to the same hospital over and over again, that might be enough for you. But if you happen to be in a situation where if you were picked up by an ambulance, for example, you could be taken to a different one, then what you would want is your state, every state has a free resource. We'll make sure we put these things on the website in our community site so you can all access it, where you can download for free an advanced health directive and a POA, and you can sign it, go to a notary at a bank or wherever, and it will work for the entire state, which means any hospital you go to, you bring a copy of that, they scan it into your chart, and they have it done.
It sounds like a lot, right? It kind of sounds like a hassle. But for me, and my sister stressed this, it was important that things were going to be done the way that I wanted them to be done. So yeah, it was a hassle and I was signing different stuff and she was explaining it to me, but it was important. And I suggest doing it if you have a person you can designate and that you have all these directives that you want to be adhered to. I think it is the smartest direction to take.
And I'm not a lawyer, but there are so many questions in there that you have so much control over. She could have said in her health directive and POA, the overall Ohio State one, she could have said, Ohio the state, not Ohio State, the hospital, but she could have said, I only want Julie to be able to deposit, not to pay bills. I only want Julie to be able to this, that, whatever. It can be very specific. There's 21 questions on most of them that are basic that you can choose yes or no down the line. You don't need to give someone full control in order for them to have what they need to advocate for you at the hospital.
Like my finances, I kept with my partner. We owned a house together. We had bank accounts together. So the finances portion, I did not direct towards my sister. I kept that in squarely in his hands.
So we're obviously in a situation now at this point in her care.
It's heightened.
And people did trust me enough to make certain decisions. And her partner at the time, when we were going through this, didn't tell me, and I hope it's okay that I'm sharing this, but said to Stacy, who later shared with me, he was worried about, can she take our house? Can she this? Can she that?
It was a very scary situation with my health. And things were rapidly changing, and he didn't have all the education needed to completely understand.
Nobody does.
None of us did.
Yeah, nobody does. Unless you've been through this, like, you really don't. I mean,
no, I can say specifically for me, it was so over my head, and it was his as well, that it was kind of like, well, Stace, what are you signing to her? What are you doing here? You know, this is scary. So it was completely within his right, and it makes complete sense that he would have gotten scared as to what this paperwork, which again, is very official, signed by a notary, entailed.
How long did it last was a great question. And also, even though he might have trusted me, it's still one of those things like, well, what does this really mean? And you were not of the age where you were going to estate planning where somebody would be explaining all of this to you. Young people are not going to estate planners really and getting this stuff done. So anyway, we also had to do a will. We had to do a lot of things, but getting back to the advanced health directive. So now we have that. You can put the limits on the times that or the hospital by just using that. You have a lot of control over what the person can and can't do.
And that's important.
It is, but you do need to share with them all of your medical information and allow them to be able to get that.
There are so many things as a patient that you cannot control. Everything else is, you just kind of have to go along with the ride, and the nurses come in and you have blood taken at all hours, and the doctors tell you this, and they just give you medication, and unless you ask, sometimes they don't tell you what it's for or what it is. And so this is something that the patient has control over.
Absolutely.
And I think that's also important for the patient's state of mind.
And I would not be a health advocate for a person who didn't at least give me enough of the controls for me to do my job, because there's enough pressure involved. And that was hard to explain to everybody. But once we got past that, then now that's in place. So now I'm POA and I'm her advanced health directive. Now is when it gets a little bit confusing. And we're going to put these resources up there too. If you are applying for Medicaid and Medicare, and I highly recommend that you do, because the day that you apply, if you receive it, it's retroactive to that date. Now, of course, in current politics and whatever, this stuff might change, but that's how it is. So Social Security Administration, the state level, Medicare, Medicaid, the day that you apply, if you get accepted.
And it's a process. Obviously, you don't apply and the next day you find out, yay, we're in.
It's a process.
But it retroactive goes back.
It goes back. So you want to do that as quickly as you can in this process, right? And sometimes that's hard because you don't know what's going on. You're still trying to figure it out. But I recommend you just do that. Do that like in the ER. It's online. Just get it done. You got all this time on your hands. It's a good way to distract. But on those papers, they will ask for a legal representative. And in those cases, they don't want your POA or your advanced health directive. All they need is another form, their own form, that you have to fill out. So I guess what I'm saying is that even though it sounds like, oh, we do this advanced health directive and this POA, and now I'm covered and I've got all this. Nope. Each individual agency is going to then require you to do an additional document, which luckily doesn't have to be notarized, just has to be signed by the patient. But I was always willing to explain everything.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But
I didn't want to hear it most of the time.
It wasn't necessarily that she didn't want to hear it, but she was already dealing with so much that day.
So much.
So that's another piece of this is how often do you bring these things and when do you bring them? I tried to bring them to her mostly in the mornings after she had blood draw around the time of some meal if she was an NPO so that we could have a discussion and a conversation that felt a little bit more normal and a little less forced. I wasn't coming to her at midnight saying, I need you to sign these papers before whatever. I was trying to be thoughtful about, I'm going to try to do this only one time a day. I would always offer to explain and she could read over and give her time and space. In our case, she very quickly said, nope, I trust you. But if that were the case and you're the advocate, be prepared to explain what this is because you wouldn't know unless you've been through this before or some sort of estate planning.
For me, I cannot stress this enough. Killing an organ is extremely painful. But the time I'm in and out of the hospital so frequently, I'm just carrying around some 12-pound luggage. It is inside me. It does not work anymore. I just have to carry it around. And it's just so painful. And so when she says she would come to me like mid-morning, I had had breakfast. I had had the first round of pills.
Before pain pills.
Yeah. But I was still cognizant, right?
That's right.
So I had just the first round. And my days would go downhill very quickly.
Yep.
And there wasn't much I could concentrate on because it was so painful. So timing, she's right, is very important.
Also, the timing is when you have doctors coming around for rounds, the people that are working at the hospital, the regular 8 to 5, and actually hospitals don't go 8 to 5. They go often 7 to 3. So there were times where I was trying to get the notary, but she was out by 2. So you're doing a lot of planning on how to get to the social worker, how to schedule this and that, not wanting to miss rounds with the doctor. So you're stuck in the hospital room with her. There were times where I was there at 6 a.m., because they could do rounds from 6 to 10. And who knew where she was going to be? And I didn't want to miss those rounds. But I also had to schedule time with the financial aid officer at the hospital, the notary, all these different departments that you have to deal with. And the financial department is, yes, they might be very helpful. And some of them have coordinators that help with that. But they've got however many patients. So you got to schedule a time. Even if you're at the hospital, you have to come in and be available during a time when they have. And often once you meet with them, that's when they give you all the paperwork. Then you got to go back and you got to get all this stuff signed and done. And then you got to bring it back to them. So it's not a one-stop shop. Like you don't have a 15-minute meeting with a social worker. No, you have a 15-minute meeting to talk about all the things you need to do. And then you need to do all those things. And then you need to bring all those things back. And then they need to be processed. So this is like multi-step. So go into it with the expectation, which is what I wish someone had told me, that a single thing that feels simple is going to take you potentially 8 hours on hold and 5 days to get done. So that's an important expectation, is it's not quick.
I don't want to say that the objective is to make things hard for certain things to be processed, but it is difficult. Even the wording is not completely simple and straightforward.
It's a legal document, so it's got the legalese.
I don't think, in my opinion, as a patient, I could have handled this on my own correctly.
I know that some people have to do this all on their own, and I know some of our listeners might be in a situation where they have to do this. And what I can say is that when you're sick and you don't feel well, I would imagine it would take so much longer to get through some of these things that I was able to knock out with extreme attention to
precision.
Detail. Yeah. You know, sometimes spending 2 hours working on an application online. And then the other part of this is that you have to get, I was going to say, because you have to get all this information. I had to go to her for how much money do you have in your checking account? I had to ask really hard questions that were very intrusive. And she understood that. And I understood that. But depending on how well you know the person and your relationship with that person, it's not easy to approach somebody and say, I need to know exactly how much money you have in your checking account. And I need to know exactly how much your mortgage is and your car payment.
The patient's person that they choose for their POA, their health advocacy, has to be a trusted person.
Yes.
Has to be a person that you are comfortable being transparent with. I had said, there's not a lot of control when it comes to being a patient. This is just one more of those things. But in the end, it alleviated pressure from me to where I could just concentrate on trying to get better, on doing everything and willing my body to do what it could because I wasn't worried about filling out certain papers.
And there can be a situation where, like my mom, my stepdad, Stacy's partner, and even herself, if I wasn't in the picture, let's say, maybe none of those people would have been fully able to take on the task the way that I did. So there's some options here I want to point out. use the social worker at the hospital. Use the financial aid coordinators.
They are there for help.
They will come to your room and they will walk you through the process. When you get older, having the potential for confusion to occur around specific items.
And this stuff is really weighty and it's very detail oriented. So having someone around, if you're having to work with the social worker or finance.
Yeah. So our mom is going to be 79 this year. And I've said to her and her husband, my stepdad, Stacy's dad, neither of you should ever be going to a doctor's appointment alone. Because when you're nervous and you're also thinking about all this stuff, you need a person who's accurately hearing what's being said. In this case, that's true every time somebody's in the room. And things are constantly changing because your blood levels are changing and they're changing what they're giving you. There's a lot of variability here. And there's a lot of pivoting that happens and sometimes quickly. So not only is it support like comfort, but there's also a psychological piece to this. Mom, for example, and our stepdad, I've been asking them to get an accurate will, POA health directive for years. And a lot of times people don't want to do it because it means they're thinking about death.
Yeah, you get faced with your mortality. I had no choice. I mean, I was right there turning the knob on the door. You know, I had no choice but to make sure the specific directives that I had for certain things went certain ways. So when you came to me with a will, it was just one more ice cold realization that things were coming downhill for me. But I chose to look at it positively and say, well, this is how I get everything straightened out. This right. is how when I'm gone, what my wishes are honored.
I've been the other way. Like maybe I've just been more comfortable with my own mortality for a long time.
That's probably true.
But I also think it was more like I didn't want to burden other people. I wanted everything squared away so that if I got hit, the hit by the bus strategy, if
That's
I got hit by
much
a bus.
Like grandma.
Yeah. If I got hit by a bus, I wanted everything done so that my person, my people would not have to have that burden and suffer further. They're already grieving, I hope.
Grandma had everything planned. I don't know if you remember, down to the readings.
Down to what she was wearing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She.
I'm not quite that far.
But I think it did alleviate some mm-hmm. of the stuff that happens when someone close to you passes away.
Also, my biological dad was an international finance professor, and I grew up hearing all about finance and business. So to me, it wasn't like an admission of my mortality. It was more like, this is no different than when you keep your mortgage paperwork. For me growing up, it was never something that was scary. It was, oh, this is part of being an adult. No different than opening a life insurance policy or putting down your beneficiary. It was the same for me. My first experience with death and dying with a really close relative was when I was in high school. So I'd had experiences of watching a person decline from a health perspective, in and out of the hospital. And I was old enough in my high school years and part of his care. We rotated the three of us, right? My mom, my grandma, my dad and I, that I was right there with it. So maybe part of this is just for me, having had some of those experiences made this less exceptional.
You are very good with compartmentalization.
Yeah, I was.
So although I was very important to you, I am very important to you, you were able to switch off that part. And since we both had the same goals in mind, let's get everything straightened out. So if things do go bad, it's handled. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we want her to live. Mm-hmm. You're just very good at putting stuff in its place within your brain so that you can focus just on this without thinking or falling apart because you see me writhing in pain for hours.
Luckily now I've had some therapy, so I'm doing less compartmentalization and disassociation, but it helps in this moment. Interestingly, when you were saying that, it reminded me that mom and dad used to get really upset with me during this paperwork timeframe. Why are you doing this? It's not like she's going to die. And I had to explain to them that I'm doing this because even though we're going to do everything we can to fight and get her to a place, this allows me to do that. And also, it's a preventative thing. In other words, having an advanced health directive does not mean that your health advocate or your person believes that you're doomed. It's just putting things in order. If we could separate the feelings from the facts, I think that would be really helpful. So what I ended up doing in that conversation, which eventually got through, was saying to them, I have the exact same hope and intention that you do. But in order to do that work, I need these powers.
When this paperwork is filled out, when it is, it's filed. So when nurses come in, doctors come in, when they see my chart and everything, they can see that I have made these preparations. And I do believe it benefited me and our family in a way that it showed that this is serious. We're taking it seriously. We want her to live and everything, but we are prepared to make sure things go smooth in the way of decision making.
And it is on paper evidence that you have support, which is by far
very good point.
An important thing for getting through the UNOS list or even just no matter what, if you're not going through UNOS, it's good for doctors, nurses, and teams that are caring for you to see that you have other people. I think, unfortunately, if we're being honest, many people don't have that. And the nurses and the doctors become that for them, and the hospital staff becomes that for them. And I think it's refreshing for them to see, and I think it's not the norm.
If you can, this is the route to take.
Yeah. So choosing somebody you trust is really important. You can talk to a lawyer. You can talk to the local people at the hospital. They will all help you. If you can dive in, if you're just someone's choosing for you to be the health advocate and you're accepting that role, then I would suggest that you look at our resources, that you make sure that you have what you need, that you then tap into the resources at the hospital, which are free, to help you get there. Now, there are advocacy services that you can purchase. They're very expensive. But what I will say, though, is that for some people, that is the right choice because they don't want to burden their family with the pressure of that. There's a lot of reasons why that could be the right route to take. There are also some local services with your local county office through Medicaid or Medicare that may provide a community health worker to you. You might be eligible for that. I can't speak to how to go through that process because we didn't do that. But I do know that they exist. And I think the waiting list is really long.
But the situation's not hopeless.
It's not. There are places that you can go if you don't have a person that you can tap into for whatever your reason is.
Yeah, there are people out there that want to help, that have been through a similar situation like us. I know that I have met several patients, liver transplant people, that have decided to dive back in and work for the hospital. In fact, yeah. My coordinator,
yeah,
her name was Julie, and one of the first things she did was show me her scar.
Yeah.
And right away, I felt, oh God, she's been right here in this bed.
She knows.
She knows exactly what I'm doing. So there are people that can help. It's not hopeless if you don't have your own sister Julie like I did.
But make sure to vet them. Ask the hard questions and make sure that you do trust them.
This is your life.
It is your life. That's right. And it's important that you're protected. So I want to pivot a little bit.
Okay.
And I want to talk about how you communicate with these different people.
Okay.
Because this is why. So the way that I would describe or talk, explain things to my parents and Stacy's partner was different than how I would approach a doctor or a nurse or a social worker. And I'm going to throw my mom under the bus for a minute. So that's go, okay. Nancy. And she, we've talked about this so many times. I know she'll be fine. Very early on in this process. Now with Stacy, things got serious very fast. So we didn't have a tremendous amount of time as a family to decide who was going to do what. In that though, I had a very short window. Every time the doctors would walk in to talk to my sister with my mom and my stepdad and I in the room, my mom desperately wanted to understand what was happening. So did my stepdad, because that's her child. I get that. The intention was right on point. However, because this was so dire and I could hear what they were saying, here's the problem, though. The doctors and the nurses are more than willing to explain whatever they need to. So I don't want to give anybody the impression that they're not going to take the time. They will take the time to talk to you. But my mom would ask a question and they would give her an answer. And then that would turn into 21 more questions. Now, time matters. So this is a little tip, I guess, a tip and trick. With doctors, when they're in the room in rounds, they have a shortened period of time. Some hospitals won't even allow visitors during rounds.
A clear objective as well. That doctor comes in that room with a clear objective, and he already knows what he's going
to
say.
That's right. It's not that they don't want to try to alleviate your fear or give you the medical knowledge. They do. But their time is incredibly limited. I started realizing how frustrated some of the doctors were getting with mom's questions. I was getting frustrated with mom's questions.
You did not hide that.
If I'm honest. Because I knew they had limited time and there was things I needed to know. I wanted to know. But we weren't getting to those things because we were too busy spending time on the, what is this again? Her liver's dying.
And we can't read Julie's mind. No. So like, I don't know to be like, mom, zip it. Let Julie talk.
So that's what I want to get at, communicating. It is really good if you designate a person during rounds or whoever and say, this person is going to talk to the doctors or listen and take notes and ask questions. Then that person agrees to, when the doctor leaves, to read their notes and try to explain what they understood of the conversation. You don't have to be a biologist. You don't have to be a medical professional. What you're doing is just taking the information and translating. If the doctors have a point person that they can refer to, not only do these things go more smoothly, but I'll be honest, they avoid you less.
Yeah, they're a lot more grateful when they know what to expect when they walk into that room.
And to be clear, I don't mean avoid like they're not going to do their job. I mean, I think they feel more comfortable and calm. I mean, doctors are always calm, but like they can do their job better. It's
the
bottom line.
Expectations are easier to be met because they know.
That's right.
Right.
So what I realized early on was, okay, what should we do? Let's do some roles. So I designated my mom. I pulled her aside and I said, Mom, and I was very blunt because I can be very direct. And
I would expect nothing less.
I was trying to be kind, but sometimes being direct and kind don't come hand in hand in those high stress situations. Yeah. And I certainly made a ton of mistakes in communicating with her in the beginning. But I said, I need you to just be her mom. I just need you to be her support and her mom. And she was like, well, what does that look like? I'm like, it looks like comfort. It looks like bringing blankets. It looks like helping her order breakfast or lunch or dinner.
Hold my hand, rub my back, rub my head. Try to talk to me, distract me, watch TV, laugh with me if you can. I mean, like, she brought me coloring books.
Yeah.
You know, just
make a plan to do things with you during the day that do not involve the medical stuff. And then I promise them, so that's your role.
And my mom, she is such a nurturing person. She has that ability about her. She's very good at loving. She's very good at comfort.
What I would say about mom, it's interesting. I would say that she is the most generous of spirit person I've ever met. And I think there's a difference between like nurturing for me, like the caretaking part and the caretaking of your spirit and your heart.
Yeah.
She's really good at like being present with you on that level, that generous spirit level. So I had to say to her, okay, mom, this is your role. And I promise that I will translate, download in ways that everybody can understand what's happening. And eventually we kind of got into this routine. My stepdad, he had a different role. He and I were dealing with all the financial stuff, but he trusted me to take care of things and then come to him and say, I need you to do this.
And he flourished in that role because my dad is very task oriented. He liked having a job to
rational.
Do if he had to, like at one point I was on
analytical. That's what I was looking for.
Very expensive medication.
Oh.
Very expensive. Not only did he pay for it, but he had to go to a deep part of downtown that it was not very comfortable to get to pick it up. And it had to be by a certain time. It was very particular. And he liked having. He had a job, he had something to do, and he knew it would be helpful.
So I knew this about these people, so I gave their roles, their jobs to them appropriately.
So smart,
and then
really.
I promised, hey, I'm going to download. So now I'm the person that's doing all the point conversation with the doctors and the nurses. And I said to them, not that you can't ask questions, but think about this before you ask. Is this a question I can ask Julie? Or is this a question I need to ask the doctor? And when that distinction was made, what came through with that is they wanted the answers, but it didn't necessarily matter who they came from.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was easier to transition into these roles.
And you also broke it down so much easier. For anyone listening to this, designating these roles and putting people in these trusted positions in reference to the patient, right? The patient is this little circle in the middle, and then these are the people rotating around in their roles. Had this been straight from the beginning, man, it would have been smoother.
I suffered.
So much smoother.
Not to be selfish, but I suffered. So hard in the first 3 weeks to month of her big hospital stay, where we knew this was going to be, this was the end. If I had thought ahead, this is what is going to happen, that I'm going to be frustrated in the room during rounds. I'm going to have nurses confused because mom said this, Julie said this, Bruce said that. If I had taken the time, which there was no time, but to think about that, I would have done that from the get. And I would have slept more. I would have been more calm because my role was clear. Their role was clear. His role was clear.
And you're a planner too.
I am.
That calms a part of your brain when there is a plan put in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It drives her a little bit crazy because she's a little bit more spontaneous. I'm what I call planned spontaneity. I can do a little bit. So yeah, make sure everybody's on board. Also, people, when they have jobs to do, they feel better. So here's an example. I tell people, I'm a teacher. We've mentioned that. And I tell my students that are taking really hard things to ask the people that support them to help them through the semester, as this is like a really hard gateway class. But I tell them, don't just say, I need help. Tell them specifically what they can do. Like, oh, I cannot do the laundry on Saturdays. Can you just take that off my plate? I cannot do dinner on Wednesday because I have to study. All of a sudden, when people have jobs to do in dire circumstances where they're very stressed out and very upset and grieving and sad, even completing the smallest task is still an achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives some order to a chaotic situation.
Yeah, like I said with Dad, he loved having those
things
tasks
to do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because he couldn't
Made
just stand around
useful.
And watch his daughter suffer.
Yeah, because his hands were tied. There was absolutely zero he could do. And my dad is a doer. He's just a call to action. Mm-hmm. And he's going to take care of things. And, you know, his hands were tied. He just watches me in pain.
Yeah, I don't think he'll mind me saying this either. But he and I met in the hallway, one of the early instances. And he saw what I was doing with mom, cutting her off and all this stuff. Before we
it's
had
not
come,
funny, but I'm sorry.
Before we had come up with the roles. And I could feel it. He didn't say these words, but I could feel it. He just felt like helpless. Like, I don't know what to do. He's like, I don't understand what's happening. I know you're going to explain it to me, but I don't understand what's going on. And I feel like I feel hopeless. And he didn't say that. He said, please tell me what to do. So
well,
translates.
For extra context, I was my dad's baby girl. He called me Baby Stace all the way up until high school. And then I became Junior Stace, you know, so it was always kind of like this fun little nickname. I was never Adult Stace.
<That's true. laughs>
You know, I was Baby Stace for a long time.
Yes. People deal with trauma and stress differently. And I think we're back to this idea of grace.
From the patient point of view, continues on to nurses, coordinators, doctors. Every day someone would come in and clean my room, sweep the floor, even them. This is an awful story, which I will just barely touch on. But transferring from one hospital to another, they used two different IV systems. One was an IV system in my neck and one was one in my arm. So we were transferring out of the neck IV system and into my arm. And it wasn't as good of a process as it should have been. And the IV out of my neck was taken, and I ended up spraying out some blood out onto the wall. I did not freak out. I couldn't feel it. The people in the room, I could see on their faces, like my mother, she freaked out. But I knew the nurse hadn't done it on purpose. Having that grace, they're there to do a job. No one has intentions in any way to not help you succeed. They don't want you there any more than you are there. They want you to get better and move on.
And there's things they can't anticipate, right? So like you're in a larger vessel, and so the volume's higher, the pressure's higher because it's closer to your heart. There's so much going on there. And in her particular illness, you know, she was a bleeder. Like she was
yes.
had thinned blood. And so there was a lot going on there. So roles are important to designate. And I would also like to say that checking in then was important. So I did a schedule. so that we knew what day we were going to be where. And then I would check in with people and say, are we doing okay? And do you have any questions? So, I mean, it's project management. I hate to say it, but it is.
Some days I didn't want anybody there. Some days I wanted to be on my own. So not only was she checking in with my mom and my partner and my dad and herself, but also with the patient, because there's a lot going on in the patient's head when you are there. And there's a lot of things to focus on or not focus on. And sometimes a break is what you need.
The last thing that I want to talk about in this particular episode, and I'm sure we'll revisit some of these topics and add more, obviously, tips and tricks and things that I would have liked to have known or thought about before, is how to manage conflict. So it is inappropriate, it is unreasonable to assume that there is not going to be conflict in every one of these types of interactions that Stacey and I are talking about. So conflict isn't necessarily bad. I mean, I don't think of conflict as necessarily bad. There are people that that behave differently with conflict. It's not like I want it, but I don't shy from it. Yeah, you're an avoider.
I shy away from it. Yeah.
Yeah. So she avoids conflict. I don't avoid it. I don't love it. It doesn't feel good, but I'm willing to like, I feel like it's like walking through a door, get to the other side. So I think the other thing to remember that conflict is going to occur. It's going to occur between you and the doctors because they're going to say potentially things you don't want to hear, that you just don't want to be true. So you're going to have some denial and you have to come to acceptance of that. That's really hard for people, me, everyone, humans, the nurses. There's going to be conflicts there. You're going to want to give your patient that you're caring for, that you love, the person that you're advocating for, water or food. And there's going to be times when they can't. They're NPO. And you're thinking, it's 12 hours. She hasn't had a sip of water. I need this for her. Knowing that if we don't do this scan in the next hour or two, we're going to have to wait a whole another 3 days to do
right,
it.
Right, miss our opportunity.
And be NPO for another 12 hours, right? You know, conflict's going to happen. So having a plan on how you're going to manage the conflict is really important. And having a plan on how to decompress yourself so that you have time to think before you respond is also really important. And checking in with people helps that sometimes. You can be proactive about some of those things. So about these conflicts, there were times when, as her health advocate, I had to do things that she didn't want to do.
A lot of the time, not sometimes, a lot of the time.
I was trying to be kind to myself.
I know. Yeah.
But there were times when she was too tired, which was perfectly reasonable because she was sick, but I needed her to do something. You brought up earlier, what made me think about this was the scheduling. There were probably days where she wanted to just be alone, but I wanted to make sure that a family member was there every single day, at least for a short period of time, so that everyone knew she had the support that she needed, especially before we went to committee for UNOS. So even though she would say, I want alone time, I would say, well, we can limit it, but somebody must be here. And we had to do a lot of compromising and we had to work through a lot of conflicts because sometimes for the greater good of something, you have to adhere, even if it's maybe not what you want to do. And I had to do that a lot.
Yeah, and that harkens back to what I said about no control with the patient. Mm-hmm. And I have gotten really good with developing patience at this point and loosening some of my control because I'm a very controlled individual. I like things specifically the way that I like them, and I don't want anything different or out of that comfort realm for me. So I wasn't always the best patient. And there was conflict between me and you very early on, me and the nurses, specifically when I felt it was time to go. I did not want to be in the hospital anymore. And I started likening the hospital to prison because you can't get out of prison on your own merit and you can't get out of the hospital until someone signed you out.
A lot of people don't realize that when you sign that paperwork to go in, it's not like you can just go.
No, you can't go.
You can go, but if you're healthy enough to go, if they decide and you have to sign legal
and
waivers.
And they'll fight you every step of the way. Like, even though technically it's within your rights, I'm a little hot topic about this one. It's within your rights, but they'll delay bringing you the paperwork or they won't bring it or they'll forget that you said that. They don't want you to go. The hospital wants the best for you. And when they are ready to release you is when they are ready to release you. Mm-hmm. No control.
Yeah, I was sitting here just thinking about, we're using a lot of C words, right, today. So like the health advocacy and the POA is kind of a contract. So that's a C. We're talking about communication. And that's a
conflict.
C. We're talking about conflict. We're talking about control. We're talking about a lot of C's today. So I was like, maybe today's session is brought to you by
the letter C.
Yeah. So I wanted to jump back just for a second into this control aspect. So there were times where I felt like I couldn't do anything right. And I think that
I didn't help that.
No, but I think I was putting that on myself. There were some instances where it was put upon me that I wasn't satisfying the need. So when people don't feel like their needs are being met, then oftentimes that can manifest itself as you're not doing a good job, or the pressure, the expectation is so high.
Expectation. Yeah.
So, you know, there were times where I felt like I can't do anything right. And you're already trying to navigate some pretty complicated water, another C, complicated waters. Hmm. So with that, I just want to tell all the health advocates out there, in the moment, it's really hard not to react when people are coming at you. But remembering that they are sad, they are grieving, they are unsure, and they're afraid. That's what I would always try to remember. This person is not intentionally trying to hurt my feelings. I need to not internalize what's happening right now and be reactive. And so I got better over time at saying, I hear what you're saying, but I need to take a break and I'll come back and tell you. And now my family didn't like that at the beginning. That was not it. It was like, we want to know this right now, because they were being very reactionary. And even if you can't compartmentalize and disassociate, which I don't, highly, 0 out of 10, do not recommend for life, but in certain circumstances, delaying that so you have time to breathe and to not feel, take it so personally, is really helpful. You know, find your mental armor that you can put on so that you can look at the whole situation from a little bit more of an objective bird's eye view. And the really good nurses would walk over to me after one of those incidents or something like that would happen, or watch me walk out of her room really upset. And they would just come over and remind me, you know, that sick people are crabby. That scared people are hurtful. And so I just wanted to say that if that's happening to you, even in a small amount, I feel you. You know, I feel you, and you're not alone, and you can bring it back in, and people will apologize for their mistakes, or their actions will apologize for them. And you're not there for that. You're there for the person that you're trying to care for.
I will say, from a patient's perspective, I do carry around guilt and shame for some of the ways that I treated you, some of the things that I said. My singular, and I really mean singular, focus was getting better. It was very me driven. And you were supposed to read my mind. You were supposed to know that the coffee you were drinking was a smell that I didn't like.
I failed that mind reading class every time I took it.
She really did. And I do. I carry around a lot of shame and a lot of guilt about the way that I treated her, the things that I said. And she for sure got the brunt of it all. Because she was my trusted person, because I was able to be transparent with her, I didn't snap at my mom or my dad as much, or my partner, Ryan. I saved my most biting remarks and my most pain for the person that was helping me the most, the person that was caring for me the most. And, you know, I'll carry that to my grave.
I can't take that away from you. I understand that that's like your feelings, and I want to validate that. But I also want to say that's really common in this dynamic, because I kept remembering why I didn't carry that with me, why I didn't take it personal or internalize it, was because I kept thinking to myself, when I'm sick, I don't have a large capacity to process everybody else's feelings. I'm overwhelmed biologically and mentally. Physiology, like your body is making it so you don't have a lot of space left to do anything but just live through that pain. And I also knew that it wasn't intentional. And
doesn't
I'm going to
excuse it.
No, it doesn't excuse it. I mean, you're still accountable and I'm still accountable. But I do think it's important for me to say this piece too. In an odd way, being the person that was your most trusted person, I just looked at it like I got to see the most authentic you in that situation.
Awful authentic me.
I don't know. I took it as a positive. Like, I maybe it's bright signing, but like what got me through that a lot of times was, well, she's telling the truth. Well, I'm getting the honest whatever. And oftentimes with my sister, and I mean that not to be offensive, she wasn't truthful at how painful something was or how bad something was. I had to like figure that out.
I don't
like I had to do like a detective work there. So when she was snapping at me, I mean, I knew we were above a level 7.
I'm the type of person
became where, a symptom.
Yeah. I don't like a lot of attention. In this 4 to 5 year period, I was the center of everyone's attention. And I felt like such a burden. And so, no, I'm not. And to this day, I still find myself doing it with my husband. Now he'll have to look at certain facial remarks or twitches that I'll have to even realize that I'm in pain, because I'm not going to volunteer that information because I don't want to be a burden and I don't want to be dramatic. And these are all these things that are inside my head that culminate with everything that I went through and how I want to project myself as a person. And if you see me on the street, I don't look sick. I definitely don't look as sick as I am. I work really hard to present this outside persona as a very happy, well person.
And although I can respect that that is your desire, there are times now, and there were many times then, when I think what was needed was just to show up with exactly what was going on.
I made it harder for you.
Yeah.
I recognize that.
I didn't want to say those words.
No, I recognize
but
it.
But maybe as health advocates that are listening or the people that are out there caring for others will recognize that it's a thankless job. And I don't mean that to sound like I'm victimizing us. I'm saying us, meaning healthcare advocates. I'm just saying it is. You just have to accept that kind of going in. One other thing I do want to mention is a lot of these issues that exist before addiction. So not necessarily Stacey or everybody that's listening, but for many people, there are some, I'll say mental health issues, but I don't mean it that way, but things in your life that can contribute to you wanting to shut things off, escape from certain things, or to self-medicate. Not everyone that is going through addiction has these pre-existing things, but I would be shocked if most people, when there's data that support this, but most people that go into that level of addiction have some pre-existing something. In my case, I'll be honest and say I have complex PTSD and generalized anxiety disorder that I've had since I was a child.
Hi, my name is Stacey, and I'm an alcoholic with anxiety and severe depression.
There you go. So Stacey was always very rigid on the controlling thing, and she likes things a certain way, and that's how her anxiety manifests, whereas mine and manifests in like wanting to be heard or repeating myself and all this stuff, which I'm sure you've heard in the podcast here and there when I get anxious. All right. Well, I think this was a really good episode. I feel really happy that we got to talk about some of this kind of like the behind the scenes blueprinting stuff.
Reliving some of this and hearing you talk and remembering certain things. Oh, man, this would have just been so helpful to have these tips mm-hmm. and this advice as we were going into it. This is really insightful information that could be so helpful during your journey.
Yeah. And Stacey mentioned research earlier. I meant to say this, so I'm going to say it now. Doing your research, I wasn't sleeping anyway, folks. I was stressed. And it was hard for me to fall asleep. It was hard for me to relax. It was hard for me to calm down. So one of the ways that I engaged my mind to try to get through some of this was I would dive in. I'd get on to Google and I'd start diving into what to do with XYZ. And if your first couple hits are going to be sponsored, ignore those. But you're going to eventually get to things where you're reading about how to navigate through. The problem is, and what we're trying to do to fix that problem, is to create a community space where it's not fully extensive. It's not going to be everything there, but we're going to provide the resources and research that I found that helped me get there. So you don't have to do quite as much searching. You know, it might be a kickoff point for you to use the link that we're providing or links that we're providing to get to other things. But you can occupy your mind by doing research and then get better prepared. So part of it is listening to podcasts, reading books that are written by people that have been through this, also going to websites where there's step-by-step how to do something. So thank you so much for listening. It's valuable for me to share this because going through it, it actually gives it some additional value. Of course, there's plenty of value because I'm looking at my sister. She's sitting right here. And that's all the value I need.
Yay.
But I love the idea of somebody standing in the hall of the 8th floor, maybe listening to this episode and walking away with a plan.
Yeah.
Or like more that. Of a plan.
I like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, until next time, this is Life Expectancy, and we are definitely sisters surviving and thriving today.
Bye, everybody.
See you next time.
That's a wrap for this episode of Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving. If you'd like to stay close to the journey or eventually connect with others navigating similar paths, join us at life-expectancy.com. Membership is free, and we'll be opening up new ways to share, learn, and thrive together soon. Special thanks to Ryan Brunn, whose original music scores our episode With Depth, and to our producer, Kinsey, who brings it all to life. And if you're a music person like us, search Life Expectancy Podcast Season 1 on Spotify, or visit the site to find our companion playlist and all of our socials. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.